You're on Access the Story Radio with Trav Johnson. We're talking about faith formation, culture, and the story of God. Follow us on accessthestory.com or follow me on travjohnson.com. My eyes are known to glaze over when I am presented with a chart. No matter how long I stare at it, the numbers never tend to sink in. Even the most drastic of mental health or loneliness statistics alone do very little to move me to respond. My eyes tend to roll back whenever I hear well-meaning religious people present spiritual-sounding platitudes in response to the deep ache of mental distress or loneliness that people are experiencing. Now, don't get me wrong, I have a deep appreciation for the work that researchers do, the discipline and rigor they bring to the table to develop a greater understanding of patterns and trends. The investment of resources is rarely seen without the evidence provided by the gathering, distilling, and interpretation of solid data. But graphics and numbers don't really float my boat. And I also respect the source material that religious people quote, but when it's presented as easy answers to complex and painful problems, it never provides the balm it was originally intended to bring. The most well thought through research and most oft quoted Bible verses just won't capture my imagination, no matter how compelling the numbers or scriptures might be. I need pictures. The data and revelation will mean nothing if it isn't personal. And I don't think it's just me. Most of us have some sort of awareness of what's been called the loneliness epidemic in our society, but we find it too technical or painful to talk about. And I know that unless we find healthy ways to mention the unmentionable, then the experience of disconnection and loneliness will only continue to spread. Admittedly, it would be much easier to pretend like the experience of mental health distress in family doesn't exist or isn't serious, but it does exist, and it is serious. And no matter how challenging the associated stigma might be for us to navigate, somehow we need to shine a light and bring a response. One of the things I love about Jesus is the way in which he paints pictures for people. To help people experience the reality he invites us into, he helps us consider how it is like something we already know. The kingdom of God is like a mustard seed, a treasure hidden in a field, a farmer who scatters seed. In order to understand something unfamiliar, he references something that is familiar, providing a picture makes it personal and understandable. Stories and parables do that, bringing us to a point where we are compelled to respond in some way. In order to find language for the experiences we struggle to describe, we must first tell stories that bring a new perspective to our experiences. I've always loved telling stories. After over a decade in full-time Christian work, I took the risk of moving away from stand and deliver sermonizing to interactive storytelling. Access a Story as an organization emerged from storytelling camps where we invited young people into God's story in a way that gave them complete permission to interact with it on their terms. And over the years, I saw countless occurrences where young people were able to articulate the love they were experiencing through God's story in the most compelling ways. In the space of a few days, we consistently saw teenagers move from resistance to inquiry. and in many cases, acceptance of the person of Jesus and how different their lives could be with him at the center. What I saw time and time again was the storytelling principle of disarmament, where instead of pushing at the front door, the truth of story enters through an open side window, almost unnoticed. There are unsung heroes among us, people supporting a young person as they navigate mental health struggles. They long for so much for their person, including a growing skill in organising feelings when they need it most. Because when your person experiences swirling emotions, you can be at a loss to know what to do or say. I know what that's like, wondering how to create the best environment for my child when they are dysregulated. That's why I've developed the Getting Through Workshop, a 90-minute lived experience reflection on how to help my person organise their feelings. You can register for the upcoming session now at workshop.resolute.today. Who knows, it might open up a whole new space for interaction. Workshop.resolute.today. My experiences with young people are why I'm passionate about seeing stories at the front and centre of the Resolute Love Project. Whether it be personal stories of our own family experience with the hope of prompting others to process their own stories, or my harebrained attempts at building little worlds through parables to help navigate challenging experiences. Let me give a couple of examples that I'm working on. This one's called $100. Every now and then, we catch our older two sons saying the phrase through clenched teeth, $100! We have two grown men in our family who are still mimicking their mother from a memory of when they were 8 and 10 years old. As young boys, the two boundary pushers share a newly painted and carpeted bedroom, complete with a flash hardware store bought Venetian blind. I'm away. And Pixie has just about had enough of the flagrant disregard for our lights out rule. Giggling, chattering, rattling of the new blind, she takes action. Rushing into the room, she catches them in the act of post-bedtime shenanigans and gives them both barrels of, right you two, go to sleep. Then as she turns the light out, she notices a number of freshly bent louvers in the silver-coloured blind. The boundary pushers had inadvertently become window dressing vandals. What have you done to the new blind? Look at it. Your dad won't be happy. Then as she laments the waste of the money invested in the blind, she winces, clenches her teeth, and angrily says, $100! Apparently, you could have heard a pin drop as she turns off the light and exits the room. Then, when the coast is clear, the 8-year-old dares to break the silence and, clenching his teeth mockingly, quietly whispers, $100! Now in their late 20s, whenever they suspect their mum is close to losing her temper, they dare to quip, $100! Whether it's a light-hearted anecdote or a more serious event, sometimes our most innocuous interactions, the conversations we have or responses we give, come back to haunt us. And they might shape our family story in ways we never anticipated. This parable is called Peach Stones and a Tree of Life. And it's an attempt at helping us navigate through the difference between blame and responsibility in the soon-to-be-released workshop Beyond Blame. The peach tree in my backyard has been known to fruit prolifically. And I've been known in years gone by to not keep up with our harvest of peaches. The prolific peach harvest has been known to go to waste on the ground. The peaches rot, the peach stones remain. Years later, Hamlet the Pug is known for locating old peach stones and cracking them open, chewing on them, ingesting them. Peach stones contain small amounts of arsenic and when consumed can poison a dog over time. Since Hamlet has joined our family, I have been far more diligent with the peach harvest, but every now and then a peach stone appears from nowhere and needs to be disposed of quickly. Peach stones are like the blame I carry. It might be a stretch, but as I consider what I leave behind, the fruit of my life, the legacy I leave, it's a mix of flourishing and failure. Sometimes the harvest is missed and the fruit drops to the ground. Some of the ground covering might be a healthy compost for myself or for others to draw from, and some might be peach stones, poison. My responsibility for legacy can provide the nutrients required for the next generation story. But if I do not do the work of distinguishing between responsibility and blame, identifying between a willingness to be answerable and the never-ending cycle of fault-finding, the little stones of poison will go unnoticed and inadvertently be picked up by myself or someone else, leaching small portions of bitterness into our story. Am I responsible for the distress my person is experiencing? Have I contributed in some way to their experiences that trigger their mental ill health? Is my parenting of them a part of their story? Well, yes, my parenting is an intrinsic part of their story. Yes, the decisions I've made may be contributing to their experiences of distress. And the part I've played might not be all of their story, but it is likely to be a significant factor in their formation. Somehow, I must take responsibility for what I am responsible for and also dispose of the blame, the peach stones. So I might be able to live beyond the blame I carry or the blame I have thrust upon me and trust that my person's life adventure might flourish in spite of, because of, or through the influence I bring upon their life. Embracing our responsibility and doing the work of discarding the blame might be the single most important work we do to open up the scope of possibility for the future. There are unsung heroes among us, people supporting a young person as they navigate mental health struggles. They long for so much for their person, including a growing skill in organising feelings when they need it most. Because when your person experiences swirling emotions, you can be at a loss to know what to do or say. I know what that's like, wondering how to create the best environment for my child when they are dysregulated. That's why I've developed the Getting Through Workshop, a 90-minute lived experience reflection on how to help my person organise their feelings. You can register for the upcoming session now at workshop.resolute.today. Who knows, it might open up a whole new space for interaction. Workshop.resolute.today. And the last example of story or parable is called Elvis in the Judean Foothills. Have you ever heard of the Elvis American Cafe on the outskirts of Abu Ghosh in Israel? If you're anything like me, the answer was no, until my good friend Graham, an ex-pastor, now psychologist, told me all about it. Graham has hosted numerous trips to Israel with Christian pilgrims, and on one of his trips came across this Elvis-themed dining experience. It's not something I ever expected would exist, but when you consider the long history of the region, it actually begins to make complete sense. The land between the Judean mountains and the coastal plains is known in the Hebrew language as Shephelah. It is also referred to as the Judean foothills in the New Testament. The region is more than a geographical location. It is a region littered with stories of the in-between. In the ancient literature, Shephelah is the buffer zone, a place where mediation and wrestle occur, sometimes resulting in conflict and sometimes resulting in treaty. It is the land where the pagans on the coast interact with the pious as they descend from the religious bastion of Jerusalem. It is here where David meets Goliath, and the resurrected Jesus walks the road to Emmaus with two grieving disciples. Examples of living in the in-between continue to endure in current times. Throughout the Shephelah, there are small villages where Jews and Muslims and Christians coexist in functional governance and community. Abu Ghosh is one such village, uniquely demonstrating the possibility of people living their lives with mutual respect, able to live together in the in-between, perhaps able to live together because of the in-between. So as I contend with the complex history of the Shephelah, the Judean foothills, the existence of an Elvis-themed cafe begins to make sense. And the annual gathering of Elvis impersonators to celebrate the king's birthday also makes sense. In a place where it's safe to meet, whether you're from the mountain or the plains, safe to croon, safe to slick back your hair, maybe even safe to don a sequin-covered jumpsuit. It's in the region of the in-between where the most obscure interactions, the most unexpected celebrations, even the most controversial discourse can happen. This is the type of space I'm seeking to foster with the Resolute Love Project. And it is why I'm working on a workshop called Reimagine Graceland. And so these are three examples of lived experience reflections I'm seeking to include in the Resolute Love workshops. $100, Peach Stones and the Tree of Life, and Elvis in the Judean Foothills. The workshops I'm developing are punctuated with stories and parables because I want to paint pictures for people to bring us to a point of meaningful response rather than polarization and maybe even fear. But I have this voice echoing in my own head. No one will understand your crazy musings, or aren't you at risk of letting a good story get in the way of the evidence or common sense? The pious religious person claims that people only suffer with mental health because they haven't turned to God. The mental health academic points to the suffering of people through the system of religion. And I wonder if my stories and parables will have any value in the conversation. But the young people who responded to our story camps haunt my insecurities about story in a good way. They inspire me to keep stepping forward. And each step I take is a declaration to religion and academia that my response to mental health distress in the family is a personal lived out story. That story might be the best way to make the evidence-based charts and the ancient texts of scripture come to life, to my life, and maybe to your life. You're on Access the Story Radio with Trav Johnson. We're talking about faith formation, culture, and the story of God. Follow us on accessthestory.com or follow me on travjohnson.com.